Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Poet Runner. Today, Richard will be talking to Julie Rogers.
Hello, listeners, and our guest today is Julie Rogers. We're going to be talking to Julie about her work as a poet, as a Buddhist healer, a Buddhist who is connected with a specific tradition. We will get to all that eventually, but I have Julie's book, Life on Earth, her chapbook, and it is a wonderful collection of poetry, and it sort of covers the range of her interests. And Julie, what I wanted to ask you about, first of all, when you put this chapbook together, what was the guiding sort of criteria for putting the poems in the way you did?
Mm-hmm. Well, first I just want to say hi, and thank you so much, Richard, for having me here with you today. The guiding kind of light was I wanted to represent the last couple of the previous 2 years. The chapbook came out in 2020, right when COVID hit. So I'd had a little book tour planned, and that was canceled, and the book sat at the bottom of the stairs in a box for 2 years. But it had been the period of time between when I started to sort of come out of the hole of grieving David's death until then. And I wanted to kind of talk about the things that I was going through and that I was observing in the world.
And
so some of the poems are... Go ahead.
And listeners, David is David Meltzer, who was Julie's husband. Of course, David will be known to many of you for... We talked about his posthumous publication with editor Patrick Dunnigan a couple of weeks ago, Rockdow. And we did discuss his life and background, but Julie was David's wife, and they collaborated on some works together as well, but we will get to that. But returning to the chapbook, Life on Earth.
There's some things in here that may be slightly dated because of what was, you know, happening politically, but mostly it kind of bears its weight because some of the comments in the poems are really universal and also influenced by, as you said, Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism. And there's like love poems for my daughter and just different things. A couple of poems about bereavement. It does spread out, you could say.
Yeah, and those are themes that you've treated throughout your work as a poet from the very beginning, back in the late 70s?
Yeah, I started reading in San Francisco, I think in 1979, you know, in cafes and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I've always been, I really care about the world, and I've watched what's been going on here, and I write about it. And for some years, I lived up in Oregon. I wrote a lot of poetry about nature, but now I live in Oakland, so I'm writing about what I'm witnessing here.
Well,
you know.
Lay one of these poems on us of your choice.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I'll mention my work. I am the founder and director of a nonprofit program that provides education and support at the end of life in the Vajrayana Buddhist tradition, called TLC Transitional Life Care, and we can be found online. We have a lot of resources. We make videos. We just hosted our 60th teaching event with a really great Buddhist Lama. But the reason I mention this is because bereavement and grief are part of the things that we touch on with our program. And I thought I would read a few, maybe one or two or even three poems that deal with that. This time of year around the holidays is hard for a lot of people.
The now going on 3 years of this pandemic, a lot of people, I mean, grief is like the the continuing thread between the between all of these years, from the start of the pandemic down to the present. I mean, there it's. But no, go ahead with the poems.
Well, it's just touched so many people's lives, and
yeah.
When I was trained as in hospice and bereavement care, this is something that was really apparent. And many times grief is ignored or pushed away, and so it becomes compounded. So I just really feel for folks right now. But also awareness of impermanence is really important, because then you value your life in a way that you wouldn't otherwise. This first poem was written for Joanne Kiger, the poet, and Suzuki Roshi, because Joanne and I were talking one day. I was visiting her in Bolinas, and she told me that Suzuki Roshi said the first few words of this poem to her. So the poem is called The Majority. The majority of us are not. Zen master said this just the other decade, and now he is not too. Those words flew from his mouth without a head count, and get stuck in ours. Think about it. No way to catch up. The dead may have it. Roll call is endless. Some of those souls may want to fix what broke, apologize, send flowers, another kiss, the last dance. Yet, we are now able to sit, watch the sky from this side, and share breath. Let us not forget.
And that that poem is infused with healing, it seemed to me. That was my takeaway from that poem. There is no sentiment in it. We are talking about non-existence, and that is often sort of smothered in sentiment and. We'll all meet again at the great family reunion in the sky sort of thing. And we don't have this year. We have the stark reality. And at the same time, there is compassion in it, you know, in the literal sense of compassion, suffering with others. So you don't separate yourself from the people who are not anymore. And by the way, I couldn't help but think of the Zen master said this just the other decade, and now he is not too. Well, of course, if this were a symbolist poem, they would go by the sound, and not too, of course, is not as well, but also not too in the old Buddhist aphorism, you know, reality is, it's not correct to say that it's one, but it's more correct to say that it's not two. It's not two separate things. So I see that in there too. Of course, that's my own projection onto it. But as I've said many times to listeners who are fans of poetry, dive into the poem and make of it what you will. Because once it's out of the creator's hand, it becomes yours. It's their gift to you to learn from and to appreciate. So, and this is a poem that you can do that with. So, and this is the first poem in the book, so it's a lovely introduction, Julie.
Oh, thank you. Well, you're talking about the non-dual view, right?
Yeah.
And also, once you let go of a poem, it is, first it's a gift to yourself from God knows where, from mind, the big mind, consciousness, whatever. Often I feel like the poems just come through, you know. Maybe you do some managing afterward, or maybe a little editing, but they just arise. And it's a very beautiful experience. And then you get to give them to others, and they do get to do whatever they want with them. And a lot of poems are multi-layered, and often I haven't even known what they were about until I studied them myself. It's a really mysterious thing that happens. Art's that way, music, you know, painting, whatever. So... well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think I'll read a couple more. They're, you know, sad, but then we'll go on to some other topics.
Okay.
This one was really when I was deep in grief about losing David, which went on for a long time. It's called Crazy Rain. Weathering nights like someone recently blinded, shocked there is no light. The darkest dark place of pinholes you can't fit through to get out. A puddle of twin carp in a drained lake. Two full cups of sake yet to share. No room for tears or the house will flood. How to save the books. How to walk around you all day and sleep with your empty pillow. Your cup immovable on the table by the boxes for your family. Certain we hesitate to touch what you held. Countless dam breakers still hidden from view in the cupboards. Recon scouts from memory's trenches waiting to be picked up to decide where to give and take your world. And then it rains.
Yeah, this is really a rich poem. I mean, there's so much that you can draw from this, and all of this water imagery, a puddle of carpet, a drained lake, and the dam will break. Of course, I know what that's like. Countless drowned. Mm-hmm. For your family, certain we hesitate to touch what you held. Countless drams. Breakers. And those dam breakers are the dams of emotion that comes up when you see an artifact of the beloved that you chance upon.
Mm-hmm.
We've all experienced that, and it's so beautifully stated here. So beautifully. It really resonates. And again, listeners, this is one of the joys of poetry, is that you can find, you know, Julie and I are two separate people. We have different backgrounds, we are different genders and so on. We've had separate lives, and yet her grief, I can feel her grief because she knows how to put it into words that will reach out to strangers. I mean, we're friends, of course, and she didn't write this for me. She wrote this for herself to heal herself, and in the process of healing herself, it's a way of, you know, a good poet does something for themselves and for another person at the same time without thinking about it. I mean, it's like somebody asked Mohandas Gandhi why he sacrificed so much and et cetera. So why was he doing all these things for other people? And he said, I am not doing it for other people. I'm doing it for myself so that I can serve other people.
Yeah, service is really important. I mean, yeah. I don't write because I want to serve, but that's definitely part of the aspiration, I guess. I mean, with work and every, you know, what I'm doing in my life, it took a long time for me to kind of figure out what it is that I was kind of meant to do. However, I've been writing for 50 years, so that's just been like breathing. I mean, it's, you know, it's uncompelled. Like a lot of everybody who loves whatever they do. Anyway, I think I'll leave this there and do some other things since we're about halfway through. There's some kind of what you would think of as political poems in here, though I don't think of them as political poems because they're about our life and how what we have to deal with to be here and to stay sane.
it was one of the insights of second wave feminism that the personal is political.
Absolutely. So this is a poem that I wrote, probably four years ago for Donald Trump, and it's called The Country as a Toilet. Politics, tissue on a bathroom floor, used and tossed, the intended function fleeting as a flush. Not to insult, but the pipes are clogged, the deodorizer spent. no claims to deciphering the news or how to fix the way it is continually running on. But here I am in the sewer system with the classes sinking into lower economics in the swirl of the drain that starts in a tank and fills to empty us.
Yeah, well, that's... what I like about this poem as a political poem, there is no invective in it. There is criticism, as there should be, but it is not of the FU variety. It basically articulates exactly what is happening to the country by the man who is sitting at the top of the throne, so to speak.
The throne is the perfect word in this case.
yeah, exactly.
That's good. I like it.
and I think maybe it was before the show or earlier, but you mentioned that you thought that maybe the political poems might become dated. I don't really think that that's a problem because, you know, when you said that, I was reminded of this conversation that, you know, when Nixon went to China in 1972, he's with Henry Kissinger, and Kissinger and Chou En-lai were having a conversation, and Kissinger said to Chou En-lai, well, what do you think the significance of the French Revolution is? And Chou En-lai thought a moment and said, it's too soon to tell. So, you know, that is a sort of like the things that happened long ago resonate and continue. I mean, so you want to go back to that when they were talking, that was like 200 years later. Well, 200 years from now, if you want to talk about the Trump era, you might want to read the poem The Country as a Toilet to see what people were actually experiencing during that particular moment in time. There is a record of what was going on. So that's what makes it timely to me. It'll always be timely because of that.
Yeah. Well, I think that when we really open ourselves and experience our life and the lives of others, there is always truth in it, and it can span, you know, a long time. So I wanted to read this poem next called Hen House, which is about being a mother, and I wrote it for my daughter Sange Land. And I was a single parent for 18 years, and I had one daughter, an only child. And when she moved out, it was so awful. I missed her so much, you know. She was like my companion, even through all the torrents and tumultuous teenage years, you know. We're very, very close now. But I'd like to read this poem for Sange and for all the moms. Hen House. The mother is never done. Her hands work her heart, Play-Doh shapes. The mold cuts her to size. She looks in the mirror of her child's eyes and stares back. She holds a bottle, a receiver, a broom, remembers not knowing what to do, but she never stops talking. Her voice, an alarm clock, bullhorn, lullaby, crackling long distance, muttering under her breath, quick prayers, hopes, like great clouds on the horizon. She tells herself to let go. All birds fly. She cleans and cleans the nest, its emptiness, its clutter of songs. She learns to sing a new tune. She's off key, but carries on late at night when the other hens are quiet.
This
poem comes from, I just wanted to mention this because it's in progress or process. I started writing for Sange when I was pregnant. So I've put together an unpublished manuscript that I've been writing for 39 years. Wow. And I still have to add a lot of things from the recent years. It almost was published twice, once by Penguin, actually. But it wasn't sexy enough. It's kind of a story of a single mother with an only daughter. I think it really exposes us women in that situation. And, you know, my daughter has really appreciated it, but I've not ever had a chance to do anything with it. So there's a lot of others, but I put this poem in here because it's one that really holds with me. It doesn't matter how old he becomes, you know, or how old I am. Once you have a child, you're always a mother. Once a mother, always a mother.
Yeah.
And again, a poem about...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I wanted to tell our listeners again that this is another poem that you can read over and over again. You know, you can appreciate it. You can appreciate it on the surface, but when you read it a second time, you get more from it. And that's what makes good poetry is the ability to go into a poem more than once, to dive in, as I said earlier, and swim around in it, which I think is one of the great pleasures of poetry. And, you know, this is a fine example of that.
You're very kind, Richard. Thank you. Appreciate that. One thing that's been becoming very apparent to me is that I'm aging, and I've written about it somewhat, and this is a poem from that arena, and it's called Mugshot. Turning gray is just another disguise. Wrinkles thicker than thieves with heavy bags under eyes blurring, distances farther off. Whenever I look up close, that face in the photo is someone else, certainly not me. Mine got lost in the mirror ages ago. Went off with that blonde. Remember her? Didn't stay long, though I thought she'd never leave. Took what I had and left me with this.
Yeah, and that's another poem that I like because there is an acceptance of aging, and that is tough, and especially in our culture, which fetishizes feminine beauty above all things. You know, you've got to look like this babe all your life, and there's a whole plastic surgery industry and all that stuff going on. And that is something I think there was a feminist critique of that called the beauty trap that came out in the late 70s. But yeah, that has been an issue. And let's face it, we are all to some extent prisoners of our culture, or at least we have some kind of indoctrination from that culture that some of us, at least, are fortunate to become aware of and sort of decondition ourselves. Because otherwise, the people that buy into that 100% have increased. I mean, we talk about suffering, about old age as suffering. Well, if you don't deal with it, you are compounding it. And Mugshot addresses that fact of old age. And speaking for myself, you know, I've been a bicycle rider all my life, and I began to feel my age when I could no longer ride uphill without huffing and puffing and straining.
No, I totally understand. And, you know, it's such a burden, particularly for women, to keep this appearance up. I mean, the fact is, I am more confident. I like myself more. I have a deeper relationship with life now than I did when I was young. When I was young, I really didn't have a clue about whether I was cute or not. Turns out, I was. I don't feel cute anymore. But, you know, I feel like I'm a woman. I'm a mature woman, and I do not want to carry this old baggage. Not old bag, but old baggage of our culture.
Yeah.
that wants me to look and be a certain way. You know, it's very restrictive and it's not healthy. So I have a lot to say about that, as you can tell.
Yes.
So maybe I'll switch. We have a few minutes left.
Yeah.
I have a couple more. Is that all right?
Okay. Sure.
I'm trying to figure out which I really want to read. I'll read this poem called, I'd like to bring it up here because it's the holidays. I'm not going to read all the heavy stuff that's in this little book. But were you going to say something?
No, I was saying, go ahead.
Oh, okay. This is a poem I wrote for my daughter, but it could have been, I wrote it for myself, actually, some years back. And it's trying to deal with the intensity of love and how it can take you places you never thought you would go, wanted to go, probably where you need to go in order to mature as a human being, but it can really be tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is called Worldview. If you get stuck by love, the thorn of roses through your heart, the soles of your shoes, spearing your mind, thoughts pierced by the hottest poker there is, straight out of the fire and through you, far beyond Cupid's raw arrow, deeper. We're talking harpoons here. Love so tough it takes you down to the floor to face your reflection in the linoleum. The heart you imagine yours, lost. Your personal balloon's ephemeral skin popping mid-air. Your very essence blowing out everywhere. All you can do is parachute completely bare naked, because it's all about being home and loving every breath you share with everyone off and on earth.
That's a beautiful poem. That's perfect holiday poem. And again, what I like about the poems that touch on emotionally charged things, whether positive or negative emotions in your work, they're not sentimental. They're, I want to say, realistic. I mean, by realistic, I mean they deal with things as they are, as they are, without trying to soften the rough edges or pump up the good moments so that you forget about the bad. In other words, what I get from your poetry is that life is all of a piece, the good and the bad, the highs and the lows. And mm-hmm. My guess is that this is probably because of your Buddhist take on life.
Well, my teacher, Gelsha Rinpoche, did not mince words, that's for sure. And I've also been accused of being direct many times. I feel like studying a profound path, if you will, like Vajrayana Buddhism, you really don't get to play ignorant very long. I mean, if you're really thinking and just practice, trying to practice and apply that practice to your life, it leaves no room for BS. It really doesn't. And it's about facing oneself and taking responsibility. I always think of Buddhism as the path of responsibility, because we're practicing for the benefit of others. And in the mean, you know, as we go along, we're having to face our own foibles and also accept life in realistic terms, you know.
Yes.
Life is really hard, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's why I've been writing this whole time, because it's a way to deal with it. It's just, I find it very painful and also, you know, had great joy. And in the middle, too, it's all over the map. So, yeah, there's that. And I have one more poem I'd like to read.
Sure,
that's
please
okay.
Do.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
This is really meant for people in general, I wrote it for some dear friends, Susie Hildfond and Theo Saunders, who I visit when I come down to L.A. And it's about spending time with those you love. And I hope that everybody gets a chance to do that during this holidays, these holidays, because we really deserve it.
Yeah.
And it's called More Reasons for a Good Hang. First of all, fun is good. Laugh big, wide open, fair as giggles. Happy is for birds of the humming variety. Can't sit still while singing show tunes to the sky. Great is for the brave, those who joke facing the mirror, practicing shits and grins. Profound just sits around being genuine. Love is excellent for the health, revives a tired heart, keeps the beat. Vision looks to the stars and finds we are the big boom bang, but not too much of a muchness. Inspiration is primed to jump for the punchline, grab it, and dangle there midair. Joy lives for a good hang.
And that's a wonderful way to end the show. We've been talking to Julie Rogers. She's been reading from her chapbook, Life on Earth, which you can buy, and I urge listeners to buy directly from the publisher or the poet, and you can buy this from her. She has a website, julerogers.com. That's JULROGERS.com. Go there, and her other publications are there. There's much information about the other work that she talked about earlier, very briefly. And if you are into, if you love the poems that she read today, as I did, check out her website, because there's more there, and you can have access to even more poetry. So, Julie, once again, thanks for talking to Poet Runner. Raphael, it's over to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Julie, for coming on. And we'll be back in January. Thank you for your time.
All right.
It was a pleasure.